All right, diving in today, folks, we're looking at something pretty huge when it comes to the whole question of Jesus's deity.
You got it.
We've been, digging through this Christology lecture, and there's this one piece that just really jumps out as this incredibly strong historical proof. And it all centers around the fact that Jesus actually receives worship.
To really grasp why this is so significant, we kind of have to step back and look at the bigger picture, the whole context within the biblical narrative. When worship is offered to anyone other than God, it's like a major red flag.
Oh, yeah, big time.
It's not a good thing. And I think you see this really clearly in how godly people and even angels react when someone tries to worship them.
Absolutely. So, okay, let's break this down a little. One of the clearest examples that pops up is in Acts 14 with Paul and Barnabas. They perform this incredible miracle in Lystra, healing a man who had never walked in his life.
Yeah, this guy was crippled from birth.
Totally. And when the crowd sees this, they just lose it. They're like, whoa. Gods have come down to us in human form.
They're totally convinced.
And get this, they even start calling Barnabas Zeus, probably because, I don't know, maybe he had that Zeus-like look about him.
Maybe a big beard.
Yeah, something like that. And then they call Paul Hermes the messenger god, probably because he was the one doing most of the talking.
Right, the spokesperson, yeah.
But here's the thing, Paul and Barnabas, they don't just politely decline. They're like completely horrified by this whole worship thing.
Right, it's not just, oh, no, you've got it wrong. It's like a visceral
They
reaction.
literally tear their clothes, rush out into the middle of the crowd, and practically shout, "Stop! We're just ordinary humans like you."
They're desperate to redirect the people's focus, to get them to worship the one true God, the Creator.
It's a really dramatic scene. And what's interesting is this isn't a one-time thing. It happens again, not once, but twice in the book of Revelation with John. He's having these mind-blowing visions, and he's so overwhelmed by it all that he falls down to worship an angel.
Happens in Revelation 19 and then again in chapter 22.
And both times, the angel immediately stops him and says, "Whoa, hold on. Don't do that. I'm just a fellow servant, just like you. Worship God."
It's like a consistent theme, this firm refusal to accept worship.
Yeah, and I think it really underlines this fundamental principle at the heart of biblical faith. Worship is reserved for God alone. So this brings us to the big question we're really grappling with today. Given this clear biblical pattern where, genuinely good people and these powerful angels absolutely refuse to be worshiped, why does Jesus accept it?
Right, it seems like a big exception.
And this apparent exception to the rule becomes like a really strong piece of evidence for his deity.
You got it. And that's where our source material goes with the fifth proof. Jesus receives worship.
Okay, so let's unpack that. The first thing it points to is the angelic worship mentioned in Hebrews 1:6.
Right, it says, and again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him.
So when it talks about God bringing his firstborn into the world, it's not just talking about Jesus' birth in Bethlehem.
Right, that's a really important distinction. While Jesus's birth definitely involved some angelic activity, the world in Hebrews 1:6 is talking about the heavenly realm, specifically when Jesus ascended and sat down at the right hand of God.
Okay, so this is after the resurrection, after he's returned to the Father.
Exactly. And notice it's God the Father himself who's commanding all the angels to worship Jesus. It's not a suggestion, it's like a direct order.
Wow, so God himself is telling all the angels to worship Jesus. That's huge.
It is.
Now, shifting gears from the heavenly realm back down to earth, our source material then looks at some examples of individual people worshiping Jesus. And the first one that comes to mind is the story of the man born blind in John chapter 9. This story is just so powerful on so many levels. You have this man who's been blind from birth, he gets healed by Jesus, and then he's interrogated by the Pharisees, who are ironically, spiritually blind themselves, despite thinking they have all the answers.
Right, all the answers, but no real sight.
And so after they kick him out, Jesus actually goes looking for him. And he asks him this direct question, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And the man's reply is just so honest. He says, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Like he's completely open.
He's ready.
Yeah. And when Jesus reveals himself, saying, "You have seen him, it is he who is speaking to you," the man doesn't hesitate. He immediately declares, "Lord, I believe." And this is the key part. The text says, "And he worshiped him."
Right. And the really striking thing here is that Jesus doesn't correct him. He doesn't say, hey, wait a minute, that's not for me, direct that to God.
He just accepts it.
Yeah, just continues the conversation as if it's totally natural.
So different from what we saw with Paul and Barnabas, or the angels in Revelation. Well, another example that our source brings up is Thomas's confession in John 20, you know, after he encounters the resurrected Jesus.
Doubting Thomas, yeah.
So he initially refuses to believe unless he can actually touch the nail marks, right?
Yeah, he needs physical proof.
But then Jesus appears to him, and Thomas's response is this incredible declaration, my Lord and my God.
Such a powerful moment.
And once again, Jesus doesn't say, whoa there, Thomas, just Lord is enough.
Doesn't try to correct him at all.
Nope. He accepts this very explicit acknowledgement of his deity and then goes on to bless those who believe without seeing, which, you know, implicitly includes Thomas's worship as a totally appropriate response to encountering the risen Christ.
Right. The implication is clear.
Okay. So we've got angelic worship commanded by God himself. We have individual people encountering Jesus and worshiping him, which he freely accepts. And then our source material brings in Philippians 2:11, which talks about this future time when everyone will bow before Jesus.
Yeah. This passage is pretty powerful. It says that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. It's this incredible picture of universal submission to Christ.
It's a powerful image. But our source makes this really important distinction here, right? It says that while everyone will eventually bow and confess, it won't necessarily be an act of true, genuine worship for everyone.
You got it. That's a crucial nuance to understand. For those who've been redeemed, for believers, this bowing and confession will absolutely be an act of worship, this joyful recognition of his lordship, of his divine nature. But for those who have rejected him, it'll be more like, I don't know, forced submission. Like they're acknowledging his ultimate authority because they have to, not because they want to.
Our source even compares it to Isaiah 45, which talks about those who were once, you know, totally against the Lord, eventually coming and being ashamed.
They'll have no choice but to bow.
Right. So the big takeaway from all of this is Jesus' consistent acceptance of worship. When we place this alongside the very clear, you know, refusal of worship by these other godly figures in the Bible, it strongly suggests that Jesus himself believed he was worthy of this worship.
Which points directly to his deity.
Exactly. The fact that Jesus, who so often directed people to God the Father, allowed and even implicitly affirmed these acts of worship directed towards himself is pretty compelling evidence for his divine nature. Now, this obviously opens up some pretty big questions about how Jesus could be both fully God and fully human at the same time.
Right. That's one of the big mysteries of the Christian faith.
Totally. So our source material then dives into a couple of theological concepts that try to grapple with this mystery. Extra-Calvinisticum and kenoticism.
Okay, so let's tackle those. Extra-Calvinisticum. It's a mouthful, I know.
It is.
But basically, it's this historical theological concept that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, kind of came out of some debates between Lutherans and Reformed theologians. So think of it this way. Imagine you have this really powerful king, right? But this king decides to disguise himself as a commoner so he can better understand his people.
Interesting.
So even while he's walking around and interacting as this ordinary person, his kingly power and authority are still there, still operating, but just beyond his human disguise. Extra-Calvinisticum tries to apply this kind of idea to Jesus. It suggests that while the second person of the Trinity, the Son, fully became human in Jesus of Nazareth, he also remained fully God, fully present and active throughout the entire universe, even outside of that human form.
Okay, so even though he was physically present as a human being on earth, he was simultaneously present as God everywhere else in the universe.
That's the idea. His divine nature wasn't like shrunk down or limited by taking on human form. And you know, the source material mentions that this isn't just some newfangled idea. It's actually rooted in some pretty early Christian thought. You find similar ideas in folks like Athanasius, which is why some people think extra-patristicum or even extra-catholicum might be more accurate terms, because it's a concept that's been around for a long time, not just specific to Calvinism.
Makes sense.
The main idea is that if you deny this outside aspect, you might end up diminishing the Trinity, you know, making it seem like there's somehow less of God when the Son became incarnate. Or you could end up leaning towards a form of kenoticism that kind of weakens Christ's full divinity.
Right. It tries to preserve both the fullness of God and the fullness of Christ's divinity.
Right.
Our source gives this interesting example of Christ's work of providence, you know, sustaining the entire cosmos.
Right.
It poses this question. Did the incarnate Son just stop doing that while he's on earth And if he didn't, did he only do it through his physical body? And the implication seems to be no, which suggests he must have maintained this kind of divine omnipresence even during the incarnation.
Yeah, that's a crucial point. The actions of the Trinity are shared, right?
Mm.
And the Son was involved in creation and continues to sustain all things. So it's hard to imagine him just giving up those divine functions while he was living as a human. His physical body was obviously in a specific location, but his divine nature wouldn't be bound by those same limitations. And our source rightly points out that this is a profound mystery. It touches on the very heart of the Trinity, one God in three persons, and Christology, one person with two natures.
Yeah, definitely some mind-bending stuff.
It is.
Okay, let's move on to kenoticism, which our source says comes from Philippians 2.7, the verse about Christ emptying himself. What's the main idea behind this one?
All right, so imagine you have a superhero who decides to temporarily limit some of their powers so they can better connect with and help ordinary people.
Okay, I can see that.
So kenoticism is kind of like that. It explores the idea that Jesus, in becoming human, willingly limited or emptied himself of some aspects of his divine glory or his divine attributes so that he could truly experience humanity. It's about the nature and extent of this self-emptying. And the source material mentions that this idea also has roots in post-Reformation theological debates between Lutherans and Reformed theologians.
Right. Our notes mention this word flesh versus word man thing. Can you maybe unpack that a little?
Sure. So the word flesh, Christology, often associated with Lutheran theology, emphasizes that the second person of the Trinity took on a human body.
Okay.
And in some interpretations, they even say that the divine logos took the place of the human soul. The word man approach, which is more common in Reformed theology, suggests that the eternal word took on a complete human nature, body and soul, and acted through that complete human nature.
So one emphasizes the divine word taking on flesh, and the other emphasizes the word becoming a complete human being.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And it seems like Luther's interest in all this was really tied to his views on the Lord's Supper, right?
Yeah.
Especially his disagreement with the Catholic idea of transubstantiation.
Exactly. Luther was really adamant about Christ's real presence in the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
He believed Christ was truly present in, with, and under the bread and wine. To explain this, some Lutherans, including Luther himself to some degree, explored this idea of the communication of attributes, suggesting that in the resurrection, Christ's divine attributes were shared with his human nature, even to the point of his body becoming omnipresent. They were trying to explain how Christ could physically be present in the Lord's Supper in this supernatural way.
But our source points out that Luther himself didn't actually fully teach a kenosis doctrine. It was more his followers who developed it further. And even then, there were differing views among them, like with Brentz and Chemnitz, about how much and how permanently these divine attributes were shared with Christ's humanity.
You're right. It was a topic of much debate.
And our source highlights how the formula of Concord tried to reconcile these different Lutheran viewpoints. And interestingly, while these canonic ideas kind of faded away in Germany around the mid-1800s, they had this resurgence in Great Britain later in the century, with theologians like Tomatius, Gore, and Forsyth, who offered their own interpretations of Christ's self-emptying. Forsyth's idea of divine attributes contracting from actual to potential during the incarnation, only to reach their full potential in the cross and resurrection, it's a really interesting way to think about it.
Oh, yeah. That's a fascinating take.
It is. So it seems like these canonic theories, even though they're complex and there's still debate surrounding them, were ultimately trying to hold together these two crucial truths: the pre-existence of Christ as the eternal Word and the full genuine reality of his human life, all while emphasizing the incredible love of God in sending his Son.
Exactly. They're trying to make sense of this incredible mystery. And our source wraps up this section by acknowledging the valuable parts of these theories and trying to explain these profound truths, while also suggesting there are some complexities and potential challenges that could be explored further down the line.
So as we wrap up today, the main point really sticks out. Jesus's consistent acceptance of worship throughout the Bible is a strong argument for his deity.
Oh.
And this becomes even more significant when we compare it with how consistently and firmly other godly figures, both humans and angels, refused worship.
Absolutely. It's a striking contrast.
Totally. And while theological concepts like the extra-Calvinisticum and kenoticism might seem a bit complicated, they represent centuries of thoughtful wrestling with this deep mystery of how Christ could be both fully God and fully human. Ultimately, they underscore the unique divine nature of Jesus, the one who is worthy of and accepts worship.
And for you listening in, think about what it means that Jesus accepts worship. How does this shape how you understand who he is? How does it compare with other figures you admire or follow? And what does it say about God that he would send his son, the one worthy of worship, into the world? These are big questions, and we encourage you to keep digging into them.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Always a pleasure.